Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon from Charlotte, North Carolina. This is the last word in everything. You've just been listening to the Academy Award winning song, theme song that is, from Godfather Part 2. Never before has a Part 2 ever superseded a Part 1. But this, if anything, can be the one that did. And the reason why I'm playing this song is because I am from New York City, Brooklyn, in fact. And it is about the New York City surrounding area as a result of Hurricane Sandy. People need to understand that things like this just don't happen in New York City. Hurricanes, we've had hurricanes I've had when I was living there. I think I lived through 4 or 5. And New York has always lifted itself up. The train still ran. You could go wherever you wanted if you wanted to go outside and get battered by the rain. But nothing on this magnitude has ever happened before to New Yorkers. Now, of course, we had 9/11. And that affected everybody in New York City, everybody in the five boroughs. It affected everybody in the country, as a matter of fact. But it is this hurricane will affect and has affected everyone in the country because it affected the stock markets. And if it affects the stock markets, it not only affects everybody in the country, but the world. The first time the stock markets were closed 2 consecutive days in the history of the markets, not during the major storm, the biggest snowstorm ever in 1947, and then the Lindsay storm, and then the 84 snowstorm, never. The flooding, which they never, ever imagined would ever happen. If you take a look at the map, New York City, when people say I'm from New York, you know, that could be Albany. New York City makes up, that is the entire state. The rest of it is suburbs. You have 5 boroughs that make up New York City. Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Staten Island, Richmond, and what am I leaving out? Queens. Okay? And in these 5 boroughs, Manhattan sits back. The first borough when you come in out of the ocean you see is Staten Island. That's the main borough. And you have to go through some narrows to get to Manhattan Island. So Manhattan Island is normally recessed back. That's why they have those apartment buildings sitting right down on the shoreline. And even with Staten Island sitting out like it does, it never ever suffered the major damage that it has this time. The flood from Hurricane Sandy sent lower Manhattan and other parts of the region Monday. Water flooding in, a storm surge which was the greatest in New York City's history. And this was not an ordinary storm, because it hit all the right keys at just the right time to make it so damaging. The high tide water level at the Battery on the southern tip of Manhattan measured 13.8 feet. That's about 4.2 meters. And in the surrounding areas caused the power outages just to go ballistic. The trains who have run in New York City for over 120 years never, ever shut down during any hurricane, major disaster, or anything. The only time they were rerouted is when the Twin Towers came down, because that was the junction point for all of them coming in lower Manhattan. But it didn't affect trains anyplace else. This affected trains everywhere. And to tell you how unusual and the enormous, Sandy, a hybrid hurricane. Now I'm speaking from a standpoint of being with the Weather Service 25 years. I know a little bit about something. So just don't think I'm just throwing this right off the tip of my, off of my brow. hybrid storm, this hybrid storm, measured almost 1,000 miles wide. And we are lucky that it was not a hurricane. And I just can't imagine it being any worse. The Battery Tunnel had water in it almost 5 feet high. These are tunnels that Brooklyn Battery Tunnel is a tunnel that was created to go under the water from Brooklyn to Manhattan to give another crossing instead of just the Brooklyn Bridge. And they have the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, they have the Holland Tunnel, they have the Lincoln Tunnel. These are all tunnels that the Lincoln Tunnel, Holland Tunnel go into Jersey from Manhattan. But the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel is the only tunnel, the only way it only means unless you take a ship to get to Manhattan Island or a boat. And the climatologists and the meteorologists, we were trying to get a meteorologist on the show. We probably won't be able to get that. That won't occur probably until about next week, but we will definitely have someone on to talk, to speak to the historic significance. And I'm sure the meteorologist can't speak to climate change, but the meteorologist could speak to how all the If I sound kind of nasal, I'm sipping tea, hot tea with lemon and honey because I'm losing my voice, so please bear up with me. But this storm, the devastating coastal flooding that came with it, it's just mind-boggling. It's a once-in-a-100-year hurricane which brings over a five-foot storm tide. 5 foot. They were showing one of the, I think it was Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel, had showed down at Battery Park how far from the water's edge. Battery Park is a park down in the lower Manhattan, right on the water, and it shows you how far the water came in. 100 feet. Now, according to information that I have, this hurricane, which the once-in-a-lifetime hurricane, would bring a 5.3 storm surge tide. The regular tide and the surge brought by the storm, that would have been the regular surge by the storm. It says the battery, while 500-year hurricane history, it brought in a storm surge over 10.2 feet. Okay, and by the end of this, now they're estimating by the end of the century, because of the coastal warmings around the world, now we're getting into that place where people don't believe in science. Said by the end of the century, surge flooding at a 100-year level could occur at the battery every 3 to 20 years, and a 500-year surge could happen every 25 to 240 years. Now, this is brought out in the Journal of Nature Climate Change. Sandy storm, a Sandy tide was comparable to a 1,000-year hurricane. I mean, so we're not talking about a 240-year storm that might come around. This is every 1,000 years. The city's location, which is positioned at the peak at the right angle made by Long Island and New Jersey, contributes to its vulnerability because storm winds travel clockwise, so it pushes the water in the direction of New York and New Jersey. However, Long Island, which just out just a little bit, blocks the path of the water, which means that that it has to go through the islands and not most of New York. Because of the historical record for the region is brief, the team led by his name is, I had it here somewhere, Ning Lin, who's at he's a professor and he's a professor at Princeton University. Lin then at MIT used four climate models to compare the effects of simulated storms at the end of the 20th century with those under conditions projected for the end of the century. In the study, she said, and her colleagues found, that two factors contributed to the increase in storm surge in the area: rising sea levels and the changes in the hurricanes. Now, she was, let me think, why would we have a rising sea level? Let me see. Oh, I know. It's those heavy ships that are being built. And you know when you put a big something in the water, everything, the water rises all around it? Do you think that could be causing it? Or do you think it's the polar ice caps melting? Duh. I mean, come on. We're talking about these morons here who don't believe in climate change. Okay? Now, the future of tropical cyclones, which includes hurricanes under climate change, is not well understood. Globally, the storms may become less frequent, although modeling studies suggest that they also become more intense. Projections vary depending on the ocean basin in question, and this is by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and this was said earlier this year. Climate change effect on sea level is more straightforward. Melting ice and the expansion of seawater as it warms is gradually increasing sea levels. Higher sea levels mean higher storm tides. Now, we need to get off this boat about there's no warming. We see these hurricanes, we may not have as many, but they are becoming more intense when we do have them. So please, take a look on your computer or take a look in the library about climate change. This is not theory. This is fact. And let's see who I have on the phone right now. Hello. Who's this?
There ain't no such thing as climate change. I don't know what you're talking about.
No such thing.
What are you talking about? There's no such thing as climate change. Look, you're Michael Lawson. Yeah, you're hallucinating again. I mean, come on now.
Yes.
Sandy didn't happen.
Dr. Grace Leem, how are you?
I am just fine. But Sandy didn't happen. Did you not know that?
Okay, we had to play that. I'm here. I'm sick. I'm operating by myself today because Thomas is going to be late, and I'm dragging, but I sojourn on.
Well, I tell you what, Sandy did not happen, and Brownie thinks that Obama responded too quickly, and somebody else said, some idiot, I don't know, was on Facebook, who said that at least Bush had the good sense to stay out away from Katrina for 3 weeks and avoid all photo ops, unlike Obama, who showed up the very same day for a photo op. Can you believe this? Are you want to talk about twisting? You want to talk about twist?
That's right. Heck of a job, Brownie. Mike said that my concern, people in the Northeast are already beginning to blow it off.
Yeah.
Well, Bloomberg has shut down the subways evacuated. This is just before. He said this just before the storm hit. He says they should do all those things. But in the meantime, various news commentators in New York City are suggesting that what this is all about, it's premature. The storm hasn't even happened yet. My guess is we should wait after we see the damage and then do something about it. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
Well,
Brownie, you know, heck of a job, Brownie says that Obama responded too quickly. We've got other right-wing nut jobs that are saying that Obama was, you know, showed up too early. He should have stayed away for 3 weeks instead of using this as a photo op, which was taking away from resources that could have helped people impacted by Sandy. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say.
It's just incredible. I mean, how do you not respond? How do you not respond?
And then, but see, this, let's face it, we know that when no matter what Obama does, damned if he doesn't. If he responds, you're going to criticize him. If he doesn't respond, you're going to criticize him. So
Here we are. We're still at this point where he has already been called down for not being in, for lying about Chrysler. He's not been called down by Obama or the surrogates for Obama. He's been called down by Chrysler.
I know. It's not
come on. What do you have to do? He said, you know, Brownie said one thing. He said, how come they aren't asking him how quickly he jumped on Benghazi? Now, what the heck does Brownie know about Benghazi? He's a horse farmer.
That's the truth. He doesn't know too. He doesn't know too hell of a. He doesn't know too much. That's the gospel truth. But I needed to check in with you to let you know that I'm thinking about all of you. I'm thinking about the election that's coming up.
What's the story? How's it looking in North Carolina?
It's looking good. I think we're going to win North Carolina for the president. I think we're going to win Florida and Virginia for the president as well.
I'm surprised it's so close in North Carolina.
It's because, remember, this is Bubba State, right? But look, I'm sorry I can't stay on. I've got to run. Right. But I wanted to call and say I love you, Michael, and I'll talk to you next Friday, and I'll arrange my schedule so that I'll have more time to spend with you all. Okay?
That'll be perfect.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
And that was our resident. Okay. Well, see, she went right to the point. I wasn't even there yet to even talk about the what was going on with this this flooding. But where am I at here? I was talking about the flooding, and I get the paperwork messed up here. What did I do? That's business. It's huge. Okay, yeah. Well, and we're going to get back to Brownie, but I was talking about this this flooding, which is historic. An historic point for New York City. I was in the middle talking about Dr. I was talking with Neen Lin. She led the research, and assistant professor at Princeton told Live Science, however, that she pointed out that Sandy was more than a hurricane. It's not something that will happen often, but it really gives us a lesson that New York is highly vulnerable. They never thought New York City was vulnerable until this happened. The whole city. So there was the, remember the movie The Day After? Remember that movie? The waters came in, flooded everything, and then it froze up. I mean, it took the perfect storm for that to happen. So Dr. Lin is not saying that will happen. But he said that Lin and her colleagues assumed the sea level would rise by 3.3 feet by the end of the century. At the middle range of this projection, when both sea levels and future severe storms were taken into account, the models projected much more frequent extreme flooding in the New York City area. So we have a major problem because their projections now are higher than 3.3. Recent work indicates sea level rise may be a more pronounced issue along a 621-mile stretch of the United States Atlantic coast from Cape Hatteras, well north of New York City, to the north end of Boston. In June, a separate group of researchers with the U.S. Geologic Survey reported that in the Journal of Nature Climate Change that while the global increase in sea level between 1950 and 2009 averaged 0.02 inches, sea levels along this hotspot have increased by 0.08 inches. The team attributes the difference to a change in the ocean currents. So what we're saying now is, and you might say, oh, it's 0.02 to 0.08. Well, let me explain something. On the average, you can figure that 10 inches or 1 inch of snow is 10 inches of rain. So you can see how much a 0.02 change to a 0.08 change could possibly be. Regardless of what happens, we're going to have more severe flooding in this area, in the what they call the hot spot, from Cape Hatteras all the way up past Boston. And Michael Oppenheimer, a Princeton climate scientist, he said the surges are a threat, a very big threat. He said, one thing I'm quite sure of, sea level will rise, and it will add to the storm surges. What happened when this hurricane happened to hit, it also hit, I think it was a full moon and high tide. And last night when I read the report, I believe it was 19 dead. Staten Island, Hoboken was under like 5.5 feet of water. Staten Island, was literally wasted, is operating, not even operating. They're begging for people to come in to help them. And then you take Michael Bloomberg, the mayor. I mean, what are you going to say? The mayor says we need to run the marathon. Marathon, the New York Marathon runs through all five boroughs. I think they just touch on, well, they start out in Staten Island, I believe, and they end up someplace in Manhattan. But I'm sort of on the fence whether or not they should have had this marathon or not. They have all this because since they're all not connected except with bridges and tunnels, the five boroughs, you do feel sometimes that you're going on a trip. When you go to one of these boroughs, you're going like you're going across the state line, or you're going to another country. I mean, it almost feels like that, even though we're all New Yorkers, because you are separated. But because of the transportation, subways and buses, you're very closely linked to everything that comes out. So I just don't believe that a lot of people in Staten Island right now are pleading for help, supplies, and what you need to do is go immediately to call the Red Cross because they need financial help so they can get some of these things together. The mayor now, I'm looking at it right now, is on the TV making a another report. It seems like he's on there every half hour making a report. But at least people are aware of what's going on there. Now, I understand that it affected the power was out from the battery all the way up to 23rd to 27th Street to Manhattan. And everything above that was operating fine. I saw, Letterman operated, did two of his shows with nobody in the audience. Because they weren't really allowing people to, they didn't want people to get out involved running around the city because the trains were all stopped. This is the first time, as I said before, in 108 years that the subways were not running. So what we need to do is to help all we can. I called my relatives in New York, and they're doing fine. One's in Brooklyn, and the one's up in Westchester. So if you have a chance, I know I was trying to get through there, and the lines were jammed. You could not get through. I tried all day, all evening, the night that the hurricane hit, and couldn't get through it. Because the lines were just jammed. So I'm losing my voice. We're heading up to a major climax with this Sandy, and I don't know if it's going to affect many people. But if you have anything, if you're calling from any one of those regions, you can call in at 646-716-5242. And we'll talk about it. We can talk about anything. We're going to have a great show today because at the 4 o'clock hour, I am going to be talking sports, and I am going to be talking about my high school, George W. Wingate High School, Brooklyn, New York. And their basketball team, the Generals. We're going to have, there is a documentary that's going to be made of one person who was the leading scorer for the Generals, always will be, and probably would have been one of the greatest basketball players that ever lived if he had the chance and the opportunity that was denied him if he was able to play in the NBA. But Roger Brown, well, we're going to be talking about that later. We're going to have some guests. We have the creator, the director, who's going to be on the show. We're going to have some Wingate alumni. I am a Wingate alumnus, and we're going to be talking to them. Then we're also going to be talking about this guy, John Racist Sununu. That's right, I said it. He's a racist. And he has some nerve to be a racist. He has some nerve. Wasn't even born in this country. We know that for a fact because he was born in Cuba. So, but we'll be talking about him also. But right now I want to talk about the one thing that I can't wait for, and let me see if I can pull this up here. You know, I'm operating by myself now. I mean, you know, but I'm losing my voice. Oh, it's horrible. If I can pull this up, where is this at here? How come I don't see it? What's going on here? I must have missed it. Just bear with me for a minute. I'm running I'm only running with one hand tied behind my back today. but because I'm so great. I wish I was this great. But let me let you hear this. This is what a film that I am dying to see. And I want you all to hear this song. Adelaide singing the theme song from the new James Bond thriller, Skyfall. I cannot wait to see that film. I was able to have a little bit of honey and tea while we were in Adelaide. I mean, I can't wait to see this film. I have never missed one James Bond film that was made. I saw every one. I've seen every one maybe 3 to 4 to 5 or 6 times. I got a home library of over 2,000 films, VHS tapes, 2 to 3 films on each one. And I have the whole collection of the Bond series. But this Daniel Craig has changed, has put into another gear, let's put it that way, James Bond. Because there was only one James Bond, and that was Sean Connery. The rest of them were just placeholders. But Daniel Craig took James Bond in a whole nother direction. As the Joker said in the original Batman, going out a new door. That's what he did. He took James Bond out of a new door, and he is James Bond. He owns this role. Now, if you've seen the, I suggest you go to the James Bond website, and you can see the trailers. The trailers look fantastic. They look fantastic. And this is, as a matter of fact, when I got up the show today, I'm going online and I'm purchasing my tickets online now, so I can make sure I have my tickets before anybody else. Now, what the heck is wrong with Orangehead Donald Trump? I mean, how does he still get airtime? In case you've been living in a cave, you haven't heard anything about what the Donald has done now, let me just play this for you.
President Obama is the least transparent president in the history of this country. There's never been anything like it. We know very little about our president. I'm very honored to have gotten him to release his long-form birth certificate, or whatever it may be. Now, many, many people have questions, and very serious questions. I have a deal for the president, a deal that I don't believe he can refuse, and I hope he doesn't. If Barack Obama opens up and gives his college records and applications, and if he gives his passport applications and records, I will give to a charity of his choice, Inner City Children in Chicago, American Cancer Society, AIDS Research, anything he wants, a check immediately for $5 million. The check will be given within 1 hour after he releases all of the records so stated. He'll be doing a great service for the country if he does this. If he releases these records, it will end the question and indeed the anger of many Americans. They'll know something about their president. Their president will become transparent like other presidents. So all he has to do to get $5 million for a charity or charities of his choice is get his colleges to immediately give his applications and records, and also to release his passport records. When he does that, to my satisfaction, if it's complete, this check is delivered immediately. A lot of people will be very, very happy to see this happen. frankly, it's a check that I very much want to write. I absolutely would be the most happy of all if I did, in fact, make this contribution through the president to these charities. One caveat, the records must be given by October 31st at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Mr. President, not only will I be happy, and by the way, totally satisfied, but the American people will be happy. And you know what? Those charities will be very, very happy. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, at least he called him Mr. President. I mean, he sounds like something out of the Dr. No. What is he making if you don't do this, I'm going to blow up the White House. I'm going to cut my hair. If he doesn't give it to him, what? Dude, this man is absolutely, listen, does he work for Spectre? Is he putting a demand? I will, as Spectre said in Thunderball, I will, petting his cat, if you do not deliver $100 million, I will detonate the hydrogen bomb in a place where you do not want them. So now the clown show goes on TV, and the clown with his tanning makeup on to match his hair, his comb over, now is demanding that the President of the United States give up his college records. Now, let me understand this here. He was not smart enough to get into Harvard, but he was smart enough to graduate from Harvard. He wasn't smart enough to get into Harvard, but he was smart enough to be the editor of the Harvard Law Review. He wasn't smart enough to get into Harvard, but he was smart enough to become the President of the United States. So now, if I take this a step further, are we saying that if Mitt Romney does not become president, he should never have gone to Harvard? Mitt Romney, the coward chicken hawk who ran and hid during the Vietnam War, who did not lift a finger to save one life during Vietnam, but yet he stood on the sidelines in the peanut gallery shouting, "Go get him, G.I. Joe." Mitt Romney, whose father and grandfather, well, I should not say his father, because his father was dead against the Vietnam War, and I'm sure is turning over in his grave right now to see what sprouted from his drippings. His grandfather, the cowardly bigamist who had five wives who ran to Mexico, his five children who never served a day helping the United States of America against all enemies, never picked up a rifle to stand post and to defend this country. All those people, and he's talking about the President of the United States. I mean, it's just beyond belief. what these regressive party people will do to really patriotic citizens like Max Cleveland, who lost an arm and legs in Vietnam, to Tammy Duckworth, who lost legs being shot down in her helicopter. It's a disgrace that these people will even utter the words out of their mouth. But it's just like the old story in the trials of McCarthy hearings, when one of the witnesses asked McCarthy, "Have you no shame?" They have no shame. They will just go on and on and on. Romney, which we will get into to his nonsense in the 5 o'clock hour, has said some things that are just completely beyond the pale. Oh, we're being rescued by senior producer here, who's just coming in, and you missed all the goodies we had here.
Oh, what goodies did we have, sir?
You had me coughing and sneezing and everything.
Oh no!
Yeah, but I played Adelaide from Skyfall.
Oh, very good.
And I had some hot tea. And I'm just talking about the
well, Bond rescues all. You know.
Yes, right. I'm just talking about the Donald Trump's $5 million supposedly charitable contribution he's going to give to Obama, but Obama, it's too late now because it was Halloween. He gave it to Halloween 5 o'clock. So, you know, the thing is that he was acting like Blofeld in Thunderball when he demanded 100 million pounds sterling from the British government, or he was going to use the two nuclear bombs that he stole and nuke Washington and England.
So it's just like, unless you produce your birth certificate, Mr. Bond,
yes,
I expect you to die.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
No. What's that he said that James Bond was talking to Goldfinger? He says, Bond says to him, laying on the table when the laser was coming up between his two stretched out legs, Bond says, "You expect me to talk?" He says, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die."
Yes.
He didn't know he was talking to James Bond. It's just like in the new one, they have a similar scene, and he says, he said something to, it's the same guy who plays the bad guy in No Country for Old Men.
Ah, yes.
He's playing the bad guy in this.
And that was a bad.
That was a bad movie.
Man.
He was a bad,
oh,
bad.
Wow.
Bad, bad. So he's playing the bad guy in this, and he says, and he says something to Bond. I can't remember what it is. And Bond says, he says, what's your greatest thing? I can't remember how it was put to him. He said, "What's your greatest thing?"
Yeah.
He says, "I was watching the trailers," and he said, "Bond says resurrection." because he's supposed to be dead in this. He gets shot by one of his own agents.
Okay. Well, you know.
And falls into ravine, and then you know he's James Bond. He's a bad man.
You only live twice.
Yeah. Well, not yet. And twice is the only way to live. But anyway, so we're going to be having, coming up at the hour, we're going to be talking about my old high school days.
Your old high school days?
That's right.
With Fred and...
Fred and... No, not J. Fred Muggs. Fred, no.
I was thinking Flintstone next.
No. Well, and we're also going to be talking about the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to be talking about this racist John Sununu. He is
John Sununu,
who came out of a bunker.
Yeah, underneath the prison,
you know.
Apparently. You know, these guys, here's the problem. I've said this to you for years. It makes me kind of mad. But
kind of mad?
The Republicans have this.
The Republicans?
Yeah.
Oh, the Republicans.
When they do something, we'll be nice. When they do something wrong, you know, like steal an election or, you know, steal the banking and finance system of America, something like that, you know, all of your savings, loans out the window. They don't ever actually do time or get called on the carpet or get thrown in prison forever. There seems to be no real damage done. And no matter what they've done, then right afterwards, the whole party gathers around, much like a Sicilian get together, and they give them new jobs and pats on the back.
Yes.
It's just like our.
Like nothing ever happened.
You remember Colonel North?
Oliver?
Yeah. Well, Ollie took the fall. We all know that. Okay.
Yeah, but Ollie won to take the fall.
Yeah.
Because nobody knew who he was.
He did the honorable thing. He fell on the sword so that we didn't have to put the great father, Reagan, in prison.
Also, his boss went to jail.
Well,
then he got pardoned.
But the reason, you know, we all know, everybody in the whole country knows what happened. They were like, oh, let's not impeach Reagan and put him in prison. Let's be nice. Let this guy take the fall. Yeah, all that. You remember all that? Oh, he's got Alzheimer's. Oh, it's sad. And so he pretended that he didn't know what was going on. But anyway, besides that, he goes and does nothing, gets off, and then comes back and gets given, you know, multi-million-dollar TV, radio, and book deals. And then just did the whole Fox Universe circus for years to, you know, make up for all the we're sorry you took the fall that he took. But again, that's my problem. Johnson, you know, all of these guys, they've been, you know, Cheney, you know, all of them, they've been circulating kind of like a backed up toilet. They've been floating around in a circle.
Ooh, right.
They never quite go down.
And it never
just keeps going around. Ever since Nixon, it's just been swirling, and they keep, you know, surfacing.
When do we use the plunger?
It's like a horror.
When do we lose
Why don't we use the plunger and get rid of them all? I can't understand it. I just can't understand it. Because I'm tired of looking at them. Let me tell you why.
I mean,
So John Sununu, embarrassing himself yet again?
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that a little later here. But I just want to play one thing. I love this by Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
Ronald Reagan talking about millionaires.
And that's why this plan eliminates tax loopholes that primarily go to the wealthiest taxpayers and biggest corporations.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. In theory, some of those loopholes were understandable, but in practice, they sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing, but a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
Middle-class families shouldn't pay higher taxes than millionaires and billionaires.
Do you think the millionaire ought to pay more in taxes than the bus driver, or less?
Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett.
Now, this is Ronald Reagan,
right,
saying that millionaires need to pay more money than their secretaries or bus drivers.
I mean, it's just fair.
I mean,
you have a billion. What
is he? Is he a communist plant? Was he always a communist plant? Did he try to have us go bankrupt so we could all turn to a socialist system? Maybe that was his plan. You know, he was a Democrat at one time.
That's right.
And he was an actor.
Hey.
So I think maybe he was just pretending to be.
Well, using the new Republican mantra, he was a plant. See, he was raised as a Democratic spy. And then he was trained in the fine art of acting. And then he subverted the entire GOP and took over. that we could institute Reaganomics in our liberal, evil ways. Now, this is, again, an example of how extreme the party's become. The right wing has gone so far to the right that now Obama sounds either identical to or more conservative than Reagan. And that's what's so scary. And that's exactly, though, what drives some of the liberals nuts in our party. You know, you get some of these very, very left-wing people are going, he's exactly like Reagan. That's what a Republican views, which is true. But it shows you how far they've shifted now. You know, they would not even have gotten him nominated, much less run for president. So I don't understand it. But
well,
they've gone so far to the right. When you hear that, it was verbatim, almost literal.
It's just so incredible. But you know, but I want to shift gears right now because I want to talk about my high school.
Your high school
in Brooklyn, New York.
Now, is it suffering damage right now?
No.
I have to tell you, I got a lot of friends
up there,
and I feel
sorry for them.
New York
it
got
isn't.
Hammered. All right.
Wingate High School. Everybody will know. Well, I have not met anybody that says they weren't at that game. The greatest high school game probably since I have a memory of. But I met people who were in the Philippines say, I was there.
What?
I mean, give me a break. How big was Madison Square Garden? As a matter of fact, I was talking to a person that was 10 years younger than me. How the heck could they have been there?
No, that doesn't make sense.
You think?
Well.
But this was a classic. This was the
game.
So we're talking about your ultimate high school game?
Oh,
this is – please, forget it. It wasn't even you can't put this game no place anywhere. I was a sophomore.
Mm.
But we're going to talk about this game, but we're also going to talk to a couple of people that were there at the game, but we're also going to talk about the main star of that game who happened to be – he went to and graduated from my school, Wingate High School.
Went to your school?
His name was Roger Brown. He probably would have been – if he would have had the chance, one, I believe, at least in the top 15, top 20 – ball players of all time in basketball.
Okay.
And I want to say I
– Is this that guy that you were talking about, the Roger?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, when I first went there, football and basketball was my thing back then. Football and baseball was my thing back then. And I went – and he was 2 years ahead of me. And what happened, I saw him one time, the first time saw him in the hallway changing classes. But Wingate was represented U.S. schools at the Brussels World's Fair. It was supposed to be the new modern look of high schools, all glass and lawns and laid out, not like the jails,
yeah,
like Boys Highway.
Nowadays they're penitentiaries.
Right. This was the new modern look of how a high school should look, and it was shape of a banjo.
Okay.
It had a round building.
You mean the round building. They were actually still promoting arts back then?
They had art. They had art in the front. You walk up the steps, art. They had art. It was shaping the banjo, one they called the circle building, and the long part of the banjo, which is called the arch building. And it was three stories in the circle building and two stories in the arch building. It had its own library. It was amazing. Well, I saw Roger Brown for the first time going through during a class change, and he looked so huge to me. And everybody, the girls were just swooning when he walked by him, and everybody was swooning in the hallway when he walked down the hallway. I looked at him, and I thought I was looking at, you know, one of these Greek gods.
Right.
So I was infatuated, too. I said, man, this guy, he was like a god to everybody.
So this was the moment that you came out of the closet?
This is the moment I came out of the closet. No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anyway,
that's a different story.
That's another story altogether. But anyway, what we're going to talk about, there is a film, a documentary, that's being made about Roger Brown.
Okay, awesome.
And we're going to have the
the creator of the documentary on. But I just want to play a minute or two.
I want to stress one thing.
Yes.
This era that you're talking about, you know, that ancient era, when I think the world was still black and white before they had colors.
Oh, no.
But this era is the natural athlete era.
Yeah. Oh, this is the natural.
We were talking about
this was natural.
The asterisk era that I grew up in the other day.
No.
But this is back when a guy got by on talent.
A lot of talent.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what we're talking about.
Let me play a little bit of this before we bring on our guest here.
This is from the documentary?
This is from the documentary.
Okay, awesome.
We called him the Raja. Oh, what a name. Out of New York City, he rose to fame.
When you come to New York City, you know, when you talk about, you know, Roger Brown, you don't have to say Roger Brown. All you have to say is Roger.
There he is. There's Roger. There's the Raja. R-A-J-A-H. But I have to say, Brown is the greatest high school player I've ever seen anytime, anywhere. Boys, Wingate played the big one. Hawkins will face Brown, and that's exactly what happened. They went head-to-head.
And Roger showed the guy how to play basketball. He took him outside. He took him inside. He was throwing jump shots, like you said, from Needix, from 8th Avenue.
It's the thing that fables are passed down from generation to generation. Only this one was true.
Yes, this one was true. And on the line we have right now, let me see, I bring them both up. I have Ted Green and Joe Bobinello.
I'm here. Hi. Hello, this is Ted.
How are you doing, Ted?
Doing great, thanks. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, thank you.
And you heard Joe's voice. He was the last one we heard on that short clip. Well, he was shooting them from downtown.
Needix on 7th Avenue.
He was shooting him from Needix. And I just could not believe. I went to that game. Now, talking about this, I really mean it. I've met so many people who said they were at that game. How the heck could all those people have been at that game?
Well, first let me point out, this is Ted here, that Not only was Joel at that game, but Joel likes to say he had the best seat in the house, which was right there on the bench. Right there, Joel?
I was there. I was sitting right there. I had a great view of everything, to say the least.
But you know what? You're absolutely right. So much has been written about that game, and everybody I've talked to out there, oh, yeah, they were there. No way. Peter Vesey wrote a story, and he led with the fact that, you know, 100,000 people claimed they were at that game. Well, actually, there were only 11,000 there. But a lot of people wish they were there, because it's 50 years later, it's still considered the greatest showdown in New York City high school history, which is saying something.
Well, Peter Vesey wrote an article about that game, and that might be the one you're talking about. But he said that every time one thing I think was Fisher told Jones, because Fisher was he was over in Israel, I believe, at the time, and he told Jones, who was the coach of Boys High, he said, "Look, don't worry about anybody else. You have to worry about this guy, Roger Brown." He said, "Now, I suggest you put Connie Hawkins on him because he's got longer arms and he might be able to take Roger Cage's arc to get him." So what Roger did was he went down to Phoenix and started shooting the jump shot.
It's funny you say that, because I spoke with Howie Jones just about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he has terrific memories of that game. Well, terrific because Boys High won. But he said he had never seen, ever before or since, seen a shooting display like Roger put on that day. And he also said that having Connie guard Roger was a critical error.
Yes.
Because, you know, when Roger got so hot and then Connie kept following him out further and further from the basket and Roger would just blow around him, I mean, that's why Connie fouled out at the end of the third quarter. He really wasn't much of a factor in the game.
That's right. I think he got 15, 17 points.
He got, so 18, Roger got 18 points and Roger got 39.
39, right. What was it like on the bench, Joe?
Well, first of all, let me interject the thought here. People don't realize that we played eight-minute quarters in high school.
Right.
Think about eight-minute quarters, Roger scored 39 points, and none of them were easy. Well, for him, they were easy. Naturally, we were all excited, and when Hawkins fouled out, we thought we had the game in our pocket, and we forgot about Wiley Briggs.
Yeah,
and they were all
three right.
Point shots.
Right. We got, let's see, someone else join us. Mr. Gaffney, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
George Gaffney, hello there, sir.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Hey, George.
Hey, Joe. I'm telling you, the only thing I dispute, I just got in, the only thing I dispute is it's 2 million people that think they were at that game. I've never met anybody that said they weren't at the game.
Wait, Connie Hawkins said he wasn't there.
He was there. I saw him there. But my coach in junior high school, I was in junior high school, I was in ninth grade. My coach told the principal that he was a Boys High alumnus. He said, I'm not going to be in on the day of this game. And the principal said, well, you know, he says, we're going to be shorthanded. He says, listen, I'll make it a field trip. He took a group of us to the game. He took the team to the game, and that made it a field trip, so he wasn't absent. But because he was on a field trip, the principal could get a sub in for him, and that was amazing. He told him, I wouldn't come in if I can't see the game. I won't come in. Made a field trip out of it. That's how special that game was.
Well, you know, Connie Hawkins, who was guarding him, and Connie Hawkins is a great NBA and ABA player, said that, I don't want to look back. He said, why would I want to look back about that game? He said, it was the biggest game of my career, and he lit me up. The three-point shot, where he would have had six. He kept going further and further back. The guy killed him.
I gotta jump in here and say I'm not able to hear you guys very well right now.
Okay. You can't hear me?
I can hear you a little bit.
Okay. You got some static on the line. How about
now?
Is that better?
No, this is much better.
We're better now.
Okay.
He lost his hearing. That's okay.
Hey, can I jump in here a second? Because that's what I do best.
Go ahead.
Okay, a couple of people, I should tell you, that were at that game. Billy Cunningham was there watching, and he still raves about it. He said he's never seen anything like Roger's shooting display. He also said that, you know, which is big of him to say, is also true. He said that in high school, Roger Brown and Connie Hawkins were head and shoulders above him as a player. And another guy who was there, which I find interesting, is Richard Lapchick, who at that point was 14 years old. He's the son of Joe Lapchick, one of the original Celtics, and a Hall of Fame coach with the Knicks, coach St. John. In fact, St. John played later that night in the NIT semifinals. But Richard said that he is, you know, he went to Knicks games all the time, he went to NIT games all the time, but he said that he is a 14-year-old. Well, the most excited he ever was going to a game was to see the Brown-Hawkins showdown.
Absolutely. Well, that was my first basketball game at the Garden. That was my introduction to the Garden.
Wow.
So that's why that stuck in my mind. But I want to know, Joe, and George played on you weren't on the team then, right, George?
No, I said I was in the ninth grade. I was in junior high school.
He was older. You were.
I was a sophomore on that team.
I know, you were a sophomore, right. What did Rosenstein tell everybody when he came in for the huddle? And you got to remember, this is 8 minute quarters, not 15 minute quarters, so you don't have all night for strategy.
There's not much you could do other than, you know, just get the ball to Raj. That's all you can do. And, you know, as a sophomore, I was, you know, 15 years old, I don't want to spread this around, but I taught Roger Brown how to shoot. And we'll leave it at that.
Well, yes. Joel did have a good set shot. I can say that. I can say that's true. You did. But teaching him how to jump shot and set shot are two different things. What's that?
You're not hurting my feelings. I had a jump shot. Don't call it a set shot.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you're
aging me. You didn't jump that high off the ground, though, with it.
Well, you know what? I do have to jump in here to Joel's defense, because 2 years later, with Joel, if I'm not mistaken, as leading scorer, Wingate made it one round farther, made it all the way to the finals before losing to Boise High.
Don't tell me about that game. That was the first game I went with a girl to a basketball game. And
kind of late to start dating, huh?
What's that?
I said it's kind of late to start dating.
Well, hey, listen.
Hey, Betty Rubble.
Betty Rubble. I was into sports. I was playing baseball my whole life. You know, Sammy Stern and I were on the baseball team together.
The guy and his bat.
Listen, who are the people on the starting five for the Wizards?
I'm getting a lot of wind noise. Could you repeat that, please?
What was the who were the starting five on Wingate Generals?
Roger's team?
Yeah,
Roger, Martell Wynn, Jimmy Miller, Steve Shacker, Neil Foy's team.
And did Sheridan James play too?
Sheridan was a year, he was on the team, but he didn't play in that game.
Oh, he didn't play in that game. Okay.
No.
Getting to this this trailer, I need to play one more thing in here before I bring head back in to explain something. So just listen for a minute.
They pulled them out of college. They had no clue what was going on. Locked them in a whole hotel room in Manhattan for a week. Drilled the hell out of them. But what they did was they knew Jack Davis.
Never get on the country. Knows the numbers guys and the drug dealers. Legally, they know this. I knew them myself.
Aim for life. Are you kidding me? All the things the guys have done in this world, and they get a second chance. Third book, Roger Brown, who did nothing, and they're banned.
He was robbed of his car. Those were his connections.
Anybody home? I lost you.
But yeah, we're getting a lot of wind. Anybody outside?
I'm outside.
Huh?
Well, it's not windy where I am.
No, I'm inside, but
I'm
in
the house.
I'm
inside.
Yeah, well, so what did this documentary, and Joe, just speak on to us what you were saying in the documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were saying in the film? Joe, can you hear me?
Getting a lot of static again. That's me talking in the beginning, and you know, he was condemned and hung and shot, whatever you want to call it, because he knew Jack Malinas. Well, we all knew Jack Malinas. Jack used to play ball with us at Manhattan Beach, Roger's car. They went to Coney Island. They bought hot dogs. And that was it. So unbeknownst to Roger and Connie Hawkins, Malinas was, you know, fixing games all over the place. Everything from NBA to college.
Right.
But, you know, you talk about two 18-year-old kids in high school. You buy them a hot dog, it's like going for a steak dinner somewhere.
Right.
So, you know, they were, like I said, they were convicted, condemned, locked up, thrown out of school, thrown off Olympic teams, banned from the NBA for life. It was just insane. That could never happen today. They didn't even have any legal representation. They were never even charged with anything. So it's a travesty, and where they lost the best years of their playing careers. And at least the ABA came along, and so they were resurrected and showed what they could do.
Do you think that they did it out of maliciousness or a way to get rid of a stellar player that was going to be a threat? Or is it just that he was the fall guy, he happened to be there, and it was just, you know, wrong place, wrong time, somebody that they nailed?
Well, basically what they decided was that, and there's an original a note that was sent out by the commissioner at the time, Maurice Portaloff, to all teams in the NBA saying, hold up, don't negotiate with any player who's been mentioned in the press involved at all in this scandal. And what that was a result of was 10 years earlier was the big, big scandal with CCNY and NYU. And after that, everybody was just so afraid of another scandal coming along. The NBA just wanted nothing to do with anything, even though there was no proof whatsoever. There were no charges, as Joel said. No connection in any way to any fixed games. It still cost Roger and Connie. And actually, Roger and Connie in some ways became the poster boys because they were the two youngest and best players whose names were mentioned.
Right. Really just got the shaft by accident, by being the beneficiaries, if you want, of the former.
Well, they also thought they could squeeze them because they were the youngest.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is you know, the gamblers were definitely trying. You know, they had their sights set on using these guys down the road, for sure. They knew that Connie and Roger knew all the older players. And remember, at this point, you couldn't be eligible for college varsity until you were at least a sophomore. You weren't eligible for varsity as a freshman. But Roger and Connie played with all these, you know, college players on the playgrounds all the time because they were so good. And also, so, you know, the Molinas thought that, and his sidekick, Joe Hacken, thought that maybe if I get in with Roger and Connie, we can get in with these older players. And there was also the idea that they were setting up so that when Connie and Roger became college All-Americans, which was a certainty, that then Molinas would come back at him and say, hey, we helped you out way back when. Why don't you help us out now? So, I mean, what really happened here was these guys were caught in a vice between two really powerful forces, between gamblers who were trying to use and misuse them, and then after that, on the other side, DAs who were willing to essentially break the law to do anything it took to get at the big gamblers, even if that meant keeping guys like Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown against their will without charging them for anything, without giving them lawyers, without even letting them make phone calls. I mean, it's really, you look back on it now, and it absolutely, positively could not happen today. This was pre-Miranda law, but even given that, the way they handled it at the time was outrageously illegal. And I've talked to several attorneys about that. They said that it was illegal then, and it would be much more illegal now.
What, Ted, what got you involved in putting this package together for this documentary?
Okay, well, that's a much simpler story. Total ignorance is what got me involved. And that's because...
I attest to that.
because I was doing a project. I was a sub-producer or a segment producer on a documentary called Indianapolis in the 1960s. And because I have a big background in sports journalism, they thought, okay, why don't you take the segment on the Indiana Pacers? Because the Pacers started in 1967 as one of the flagship ABA teams. I thought, okay, that sounds good. And so, you know, there are jerseys hanging from the rafters at the Pacers Stadium. And, you know, there's George McGinnis, who I'd already gotten to know. And there's Mel Daniels and there's Slick Leonard. And, of course, there's Reggie Miller. But then there was Roger Brown. And I never really knew much about Roger Brown. In fact, I didn't really even know who he was. I've always been kind of curious who this Roger Brown guy is. But then when I'm interviewing McGinnis and Mel Daniels and Slick Leonard, et cetera, they're going on and on and on and on about this guy. And then I thought, man, this is really curious. I was just intrigued by the whole idea, so I started doing some research. I got to know his widow, Jeannie Brown. They were actually divorced at the time that he passed, but he passed away in their house. She took care of him at the end. And after gaining her trust, which wasn't easy, but after gaining her trust, she opened up everything to me. She opened up these old boxes of memorabilia and news clips, you know, dating back to his days growing up first in Bed-Stuy and then in Crown Heights and going to Wingate. And it was just astounding. It was the most remarkable story I've ever come across. And I ever since then, that was almost 2 years ago. About 18 months ago, I was all in. It became a mission for me to tell this story.
That's fantastic.
George, what do you, I know you know a lot of these players here. How did you feel about when you first started looking at Roger Brown? When did you first notice him as a major force in Brooklyn sports?
Well, when I was playing in junior high school, we were playing for the district championship, and Coach Rosenstein came to the game, and he brought Roger with him. And, you know, he just said to me, you know, when he called me over and wanted to make sure I was going to go to Wingate, and so he was talking to me, and he said, this is Roger Brown. He said he came along with me and stuff like that. So he gave me, then you know, that was just Roger just nodded, and I nodded back to him. I didn't speak to him. But Roger was, there was something about him that he was, it wasn't that he was unfriendly, but there was like, he was regal. There was something about him that you just didn't feel that you should speak to him, that you were adequate to speak to him. And it wasn't anything that he was doing. It was just, there was an air about Roger that was just like royalty. Roger, I think the name Roger means royalty. That's how I first got in contact, and Coach Rosenstein gave me tickets to Wingate games because the junior high school season ended way before the high school, and so he gave me tickets to the games, and I used to come see Roger play. And I just said, one thing I admired about Roger was he did not stay in a game to run up the score against a beaten foe. If a foe was beaten, he asked to be taken out of games. That was the most impressive thing, that there's a guy who, you know, he could have gone off any time and scored 80 points. He didn't do that. That wasn't his style. When the game was out of control and they were winning, he didn't want to stay in the game. So that impressed me about Roger. And what was your original question? Because I got sidetracked with that, but I just had to say that.
If Roger would have stayed in the game, they would all have been runaways. So
yeah, that's true. That's true. They were undefeated. And that's the thing, as Joel alluded to earlier, you had two undefeated teams meeting. That, you know, that's incredible that two undefeated teams meet, you know, like that. It's just, and that's why one of the things that caused such a great turnout, besides the fact of the dynamic Roger Brown and Connie Hawkins, it was that these teams were undefeated meeting here at Madison Square Garden. So that was a tremendous thing and historic, you know.
It's still from that game. Is that right, Ted?
Could you please say that one more time?
There's no film for that game.
No, they're right. There is no film for that game, although here's my strong suspicion is after I'm turning over every single rock I can find, the second the documentary comes out, someone will say, oh, wait, my dad took film of that game, and it's right here. But no, it was certainly never televised. There wasn't even a radio broadcast of that game, and that's why it lives on really in legend. As a matter of fact, I was just talking just a couple of weeks ago. I don't want to name drop here, but I was talking to Bob Costas out in Manhattan, interviewing him for this show, and he'd heard all about that game. But he says one of the things he likes about it is the fact that there isn't any film because it can just live on in this kind of, in this legendary way, which really, frankly, in a way, it's too bad, but that goes for a lot of Roger Brown's career. I mean, he really, even with the ABA, that was seldom televised. In the years that he lost between high school and the ABA, I mean, he was playing AAU ball in Ohio outposts like Xenia and Akron and Lima. I mean, this guy just, there isn't a lot of visual record of him. There's some. I've gotten a lot of good stuff from his ABA stuff, ABA days through collectors and all sorts of other means. But before that, there's very, very little, if any, moving footage of Roger Brown.
So who are some of the people that you have? Of course, how long is this documentary?
Well, my aim is to make this a 90-minute show. When you say that to people who are in charge of these things, they blanch and they say, no, it's got to fit into a 60-minute hole. But I think it's going to be a 90-minute show, and part of that is because of the cast I've been able to assemble. And let me tell you some of the luminaries. Now, these are luminaries beyond George Gaffney and Joel Barbanel. So,
wait a minute.
You know.
You're getting carried away now. Calm yourself down, Ted.
I mean, Joel and George clearly topped the bill. But, it's not just who I've got, but it's what they say. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talks about being 13 years old at the Brownsville Boys Club and seeing Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown play for the first time and just being amazed by it. I mean, this is Kareem, and his eyes light up at the memory. Julius Erving talking about when he first came to professional basketball, Roger was the best player he ever saw. And also talking about how, you know, I asked him what kind of player Roger was. He said, well, Roger's kind of a hybrid between myself and Earl Monroe, but we're all equally talented players. And I challenged him on that. I said, you're saying equally talented? And he said, yes, absolutely, no question about it. I've got Oscar Robertson talking about playing against Roger in pickup games when Oscar and his Cincinnati guys would play against the Dayton guys in the mid-60s when Roger was banned from the NBA, and Oscar goes on and on about it. I've got, here's another name for some of the more advanced in the age groups here, is Bill Sharman. Bill Sharman is one of only four men in the Hall of Fame as both a player and a coach. I mean, this is a guy who played with Cousy and Russell, Coach Chamberlain. And he said that Roger's performance in the 1970 ABA Finals, this is when the Pacers defeated the LA Stars, which were coached by Sharman. Sharman said that Roger's performance in that series was the single greatest playoff performance he'd ever seen. And he sticks to that to this day. Who else do I have in this piece? George Gervin going on and on and on about how great Roger Brown is. As I said, Bob Costas in this piece. Bill Cosby tells really some amazing stories about witnessing Roger in those 1970 finals, being so moved by that when he found out later that Roger was ill, he found out by reading a William Roden column in the New York Times, that he was so moved he asked Mr. Roden to get Roger's number, and Bill Cosby called up Roger and spoke with him on his deathbed just to let him know that, hey man, I saw you play. I saw what you did. I mean, these are guys, this cast, I would say this much. I'd put up the cast in this documentary against any cast in any sports documentary, and all of them are speaking from the heart.
Well, if I was looking for this, if you want to just hold on a minute, I might have that clip from Bill Cosby here. Hold on.
I'm sitting courtside. And this fellow Brown is doing all right. He is doing all right. And then it happened. Roger went up with his right hand, and I saw this fellow, defensive fellow, come by. I don't know if it was what hand it was, but it was blocked. The shot is blocked, so mentally the shot is blocked, and I'm looking down. Roger put that ball to this hand, and the man blocked this ghost ball. And it wasn't luck. It just went in. And I got it. And I said, there is nothing more than a can show me in this game. And I went home. I like like that. I like the fact that while he is facing, like,
yeah,
to call and say to a person, I saw you. I saw you. I saw what you did. I had the feeling that I was giving him something that made him feel very, very wonderful. I hope so.
I gotta admit, I'm not hearing anything now.
You mean it? You're breaking up good.
Did you hear the? I played the clip from a
couple times. I did. Yeah, I definitely heard the clip.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's I mean, you know, the looking at it, which the listeners can't see, Bill Cosby's face, what he's describing, sure, it's like, you know, I don't need to see anything else.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Trump said.
Again.
Is there a film of that game?
I'm sorry, did you ask if there was film of that game?
Yeah.
Yes, there's a lot of film of that game, which is great because that whole series, there's a nice highlight film of that whole series. And the last three games in that series, Roger Brown scored 53, 39, and 45 points. I mean, it was just a phenomenal show. And there's all sorts of film in that. And I'm sure that one guy who wishes there wasn't film of that is Mr. Willie Wise, who was a wonderful, wonderful man. But he was assigned the task of guarding Roger in that series, and he was only a rookie. And suffice to say, he had a few problems.
Well, what are we looking for? I know the reason why you went on to get this film made. I mean, it just needs to be done. But what are we looking for down the road to do with the film?
Well, right now I've got a laser focus on getting this documentary out by February. And the reason there is there's a possible wonderful time peg. Now, there's nothing is certain, but in February, now what they do is they elect one ABA player each year directly into the Hall of Fame. It's not a nomination process like with other players. They just elect a player. Last year it was Mel Daniels, Roger's teammate with the Pacers. Well, I'm told by more than two members of the voting committee that Roger is the favorite to get in this year. Now, it's possible that he won't. I mean, anything's possible. It's possible Slick Leonard might get the call. Slick Leonard is, you know, if you're from around Indiana, you certainly think Slick Leonard is deserving. There are other deserving guys, but people I talk to say that Roger is likely to get in. And then the question is going to be, unfortunately, among many people, well, who the hell is Roger Brown? Well, this will show them who Roger Brown is. Now, that's the documentary. I have been approached also about this possibly becoming a feature film. I think it would make a fabulous feature film. I'm a little bit biased, but that is a realm I have not dealt with before. So, you know, right now my focus is on getting this documentary done, fully funded, I should point out, is to get it fully funded as well, and have it done by February.
Well, and looking at the trailer, and looking at the last part of the trailer with his daughter and his grandson, you know, it just brought tears to my eyes. And I was showing it to my one of my daughters yesterday, and my youngest grandson is 4 years old. I think he's about the same age as Roger's grandson was in the documentary's age. And because he loves to play basketball, and as a matter of fact, they look very much alike.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying, oh, that little boy plays basketball just like me. I said, yes, he does. And it was really amazing. So who is he? I said, well, this man right here, Roger Brown, that's his grand. He said, oh. So it was so it brought tears to my eyes to see her, how she was, said she was going to explain to her son.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe the technical term for that is a money quote.
That's a money quote. You got that right. They got that right. Well,
no, but
so,
gee, let me say that Gail, that's his, Roger's daughter, one of his daughters, that's Gail, and she's a professional model. And I'm not just saying this, but she's even more beautiful on the inside. I mean, she's just an incredible, incredible person. We had a fundraiser for this show just a couple weeks ago. In fact, Mr. Barbanel here was good enough to come in for that. And Gail came all the way from L.A. just to sort of help us make our pitch.
Oh, wonderful. So she lives in Los Angeles now.
She lives in Los Angeles. Let me also point out that she's a lot taller than Joel.
Doesn't matter. I tied telephone books to my feet.
But Joel, you still had a great set jump shot.
I still do. That'll tell you.
You still do. Oh man, that's fabulous.
We did some filming at Wingate a year ago, August. I showed Ted how to do the basketball.
You Wingate guys will get a kick out of this. So, George, you'll get a kick out of this. So I'm talking to Freddie Walls.
Okay, you spoke to Freddie Walls, huh?
Yeah, and he was talking about the game at the Garden in 1962 when Joel had a really good game, but they fell just short. And he was talking about what a great shooter Joel is. And I said, I can't tell him that. He'll get a big head. And Freddie said, he's already got a big head. And I said, yeah, that's true.
I still got that, too.
Joel did have a great game, that game against Wichita. Oh, absolutely. I mean, he gave you 45. And really, you know, starting a lot earlier, long range jumper.
You guys are breaking up again.
This is Skype. Skype must be having some sort of problem. But anyway, what are we expect to hear now from here on about this documentary, and how can we get people interested?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be real honest here. What you'll expect to hear is I'm still. We are still fundraising. I'm very excited to say that the Indiana Pacers and Bankers Life and Casualty, which is an insurance company that has the title or has their name on the Pacers arena, they have become title sponsors of this show, and they have gotten it off the ground financially. I mean, they've really, really helped. But I still have a ways to go. I mean, don't get me wrong. This show is going to be made regardless. I haven't been working on this for nothing. Well, I have been working on it for nothing, but I haven't been working on it for it not to be completed. But I still am trying to raise, you know, we're about halfway there for the total production budget. And the difference that will make is, as you know, as George as a film guy certainly knows, is that it'll be how the overall quality of the production. A lot of that comes from the editing process, which costs money. But that said, I don't want to make this a big begging thing here. But, you know, if anybody out there wishes to contribute to the budget, they're more than welcome. And the way we have it set up is anybody who contributes more than $250 gets his name in the credits. In fact, let me say this. Just today, and I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to embarrass him, but just today somebody involved with the Wingate basketball program called me at home and asked for my address because he wanted to write a check. And I said, oh, you don't need to do that. Seriously, you know. And he goes, no, I really, really want to. This is important to me. And he said, it's not going to be much, but I'll do what I can. I mean, it is remarkable, and I'm going to change subjects here a little bit, but it's remarkable the love that Roger Brown and his story have inspired among people from all parts of his life, from high school to the Dayton years, and certainly here in Indianapolis as well. And, you know, people are jumping in because they want his story told, and it's helping. So
let me jump in, too, and say something. And that's this. I've seen Ted's work, and this is not going to be a puff piece. Ted is not doing a, oh, everything is rosy, everything is wonderful. He doesn't do that. I've seen his work. And he calls the shots as what's going on and everything like that. So nobody's getting a, you know, this is not a puff piece thing. This is not, oh, so-and-so did everything right. There was never any wrong. He can walk on water. Ted just, he gives you the facts from both sides. So if there's anybody there that's speaking in opposition of anything, they're going to be heard. And that's rare, because most of the time, you know, you're doing this and you just think, oh, this guy's the greatest guy that ever lived. But Ted really gives a fair picture of the whole thing. You know, and I'm telling you, that's what's most impressive to me, because, I mean, I see films for a living now. And when you step out and you know, give both sides a shot, when you present the total picture, it makes a whole lot of difference. It's not just a trailer of, oh, everything is wonderful. This is going to be a film that's going to, you know, tell a complete story.
That's why it's worthy of support. George, I can't thank you enough. And you know what? George is absolutely right. Roger was no saint. He really wasn't. He was a remarkable guy. He had his faults like everybody else. And you know, there were times, in all honesty, and his kids will tell you this, when he wasn't the best father. You know, there were other issues like that. But those will come out in the piece. It's not a puff piece by any means. You know, at the same time, this is a guy who was essentially wronged. And this is trying to get his story out there. That's, you know, to right the wrong, to whatever extent a documentary is able to do that, that's what my goal is here.
Well, you know, I want to know, have you spoken to Connie Hawkins?
No, that's a funny story. It's not a funny story, and I have not been able to speak to Mr. Hawkins. I would love still to speak to Mr. Hawkins. I really don't want to go into his reasons, just as well, because I don't know his reasons. But he has been approached to speak many times, and he has said no. And it's, you know what? It's not for me to guess why. I would love it if he'd want to take part in this. Roger and Connie were very close for a long time. They went through the same BS. And they both came out of it on the other side. And so I would love the opportunity to talk with him. I just haven't had that yet. He's the one guy I have not been able to get.
Let me interject a thought here for a second, okay? You know, to raise the funds is strictly for producing film. The story's got to be told. You know, people might think, well, they're raising this money to keep some of it in profits. Very rarely does a documentary make money. It tells a story. And I want to make it clear that, you know, Ted's got his heart and soul in this thing, and that's why it's going to happen. He hasn't backed down for a minute. He makes me buy dinners. He makes me take cabs from the airport. The guy's kind of tight, all right? But that's why it's going to work, because he has
that's
a passion.
That's what we call a tight production budget right there. No, in all seriousness, no, too, that people should know that the production company for this is WFYI, which is Indianapolis's PBS affiliate. What that means is that's a 501c3. You know, this is tax-deductible stuff. I am not going to make – to truth be told, I'm going to end up losing money on this regardless. That's not what it's about. As hokey as it might sound, this has become a mission for me, and I think it's become a mission for me because in interviewing all the people I've interviewed, it's a mission for so many of them. It's, you know, I can't say I can continue to do this for the rest of my life, do work for no money. But in this case, it's a story that needs to be told. And indeed, it's not, no one's lining their pockets here. It's quite the opposite of that.
That's my. I wanted to just reiterate that it's absolutely essential what you're doing, because you are bringing a real person's real life to the masses. You were saying earlier that someone or that many people do not know who Brown really is, and they do not know the story behind the story. You know, when you see something like the Pacers retiring his jersey, it's like, why? Or why is he one of only four guys? And you know, I don't remember seeing him in any NBA games. What are we talking about? You know, so it's very important to bring this real story out. But before we get off track too far, where can our listeners send money? Is there a website? Is there a phone number, an email, chair for you, any way at all that we can get money to you or get support to you or get any kind of help to get this thing out and distributed?
Well, this might wholly surprise you, but in fact, I have that information right here at the ready.
Shocking.
Online, right now, we are in the process of creating a what they call a landing page just for this. But there are ways right now people can go online to WFYI. WF as in Frank, Y as in yellow, I as in, I don't know, igloo. WFYI.org, O-R-G. And on that homepage, there's a button halfway down that says Pledge Now, and that takes you to the pledging form. On that form, it's a very basic pledge form, but with the one thing you'd need to do is note, and it's like on the second or third page, note that this is for your pledge is for the Roger Brown story. You don't want this money isn't just going anywhere in WFYI. It's going particularly for this story. The other option is to do this by phone, and that is to call. The number is area code 317-614-0439. The woman there is named Tracy Mitchell at that line, and she takes pledges over the phone, does it all the time. I'm happy to say she's been getting some for this show. There are gifts that we give out. I won't get into all that here, but there are signed, you know, memorabilia, jerseys, balls, that kind of thing. There's a really neat poster that we're giving out. And again, anybody interested in any of that can just either go online and find it or call that number. And there it is. And again, anybody who is contributing $250 or more would find his or her name in the credits. Now, that's not important to people, and certainly we're accepting donations of less than that. You know, any amount helps. I talked to somebody the other day who kicked in $5. You know what? That's five more good dollars. You know, that's look at the way Obama did it. I mean, it can happen, and we're getting there. We are getting there every day. So, you know, now I sound like a telecommercial or something, but let me just say I'm extremely grateful for all the help that I've already gotten.
How is the NBA Players Association? Do they get involved in anything like this?
They aren't involved in anything right now. It's funny, though, just the other day I spoke with the guy who's in charge of the NBA Coaches Association, who was a big Roger Brown fan back in the day. The Players Association, I have not gone to them. You know, one of the possible outlets for this show would be on NBA TV. I've heard a little buzz there. It's something that we do plan on approaching. I mean, that's the other question, is distribution for this show. Right now, the plan is that it will debut here in Indianapolis on WFYI, possibly even on the big Jumbotron at Bankers Life Fieldhouse where the Pacers play. But also the affiliates, the PBS affiliates in New York and Boston and several other of the top markets have also said they will air this show.
You got to do it in Charlotte. WTIV.
Oh, I'm sorry. I lost you there for a second. But
you got to do it in Charlotte, too, WTIV.
All right, there you go. I mean, for what it's worth, the first documentary I did, which was on John Wooden, was picked up by American Public Television, and it played on, for the last 3 years, it's been playing on 80% of U.S. markets on PBS affiliates. So we are going to get national distribution with this. We would love to get it on a major cable network, and we're certainly we're trying to make that happen. It's just it's a process.
Then we've got to have a showing at the Winget High School. Just saying.
Yeah, well, Winget now is three schools. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, it's now called Winget Campus. It's the same building, but it's broken up to three different schools.
Okay. They're still playing basketball there, Winget?
They have a very good team. When we filmed there, I spoke to the athletic director, and the principal came by, and they were more than thrilled to have us there. They had heard, and the student body had heard, that many years ago Winget had some fantastic basketball teams, and they were just thrilled to have us there.
You know what? You guys might get a kick out of this. I was at Winget just a couple weeks ago, up in the library going through old copies of the Winget World newspaper. And I also saw the really neat thing is Roger's little sister Judy still lives in the house where Roger grew up in Crown Heights. In fact, George came to visit when I first interviewed her. I visited her again just a couple weeks ago. I met Roger's older brother for the first time. It's this story means so much to them, and to see it in their eyes, they live right down from the St. John's Rec Center where Roger grew up playing and learned from the likes of Tony Jackson and before that Chink Gaines and Sayugo Green. His name still resonates around there, and it's really something to go back to see that.
And Ted, let me jump in and say something. When I was at that taping of Judy Brown's conversation, there's a point in there where she mentions what she would do to Jack Malinas if she was put in a room with him. And I'm telling you, that's the most chilling thing for this woman to say. To say what she would do for this man who damaged her life, her brother's life, her family's life, and that tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, it's
she
true.
Did
it was,
not
it was
treat
scary.
Him kindly, and it was chilling to hear her say that. This is a person that would not. I'm telling you, she might think about harming a fly, a mosquito, or something. But she told you point blank, this man would not have gone on any longer in life if he had been in a room with her when she found out that he did what he did to her brother for no reason that makes any sense, to drag him down and cost him a minimum of 6 years of his life. It's just scary. I mean, to hear her say that, I can't even go on about it.
You know what? George is absolutely right. And people should know who are listening, if they don't know, that this Jack Malinas was truly a bad guy.
Yeah.
I've talked to a few of the guys who played ball with him when he was growing up. And I talked to a guy who wrote a book about him named Neil Isaacs and others. And they described him early on he was a bad guy. And just so people know, he did go to jail for this. And in jail, where he was the inspiration for the Burt Reynolds game fixer in the movie The Longest Yard, although even though that's kind of a nice, funny story, Malinas wasn't. There's nothing funny about him at all. When he got out of jail, he decided to go into pornography, and he ended up crossing the mob and getting shot in his backyard in Hollywood Hills. I mean, this was a bad guy who ruined a lot of lives. But certainly Roger Brown would have to be right up there with the some of the worst damage that this guy inflicted.
And Roger was only 54 when he passed, right?
That's correct, 54. I died in 1997, and his funeral was held at Market Square Arena.
And he went, and he really, he had a I guess, a second career, and he went into politics.
He served for four years on the Indianapolis City County Council. That was at the behest of then Mayor Richard Lugar, who of course was a senator forever and ever. Just no longer now. But and he served, by all accounts, he served very well. He went to the Republican National Convention in 1972 in Miami. He also showed a penchant for law enforcement. He would drive along with police after practice sometimes at night. And he was an assistant coroner. I mean, yeah, a lot of people who knew him when he was younger were surprised that he really did enter, public civic life in a very active way. And I think that speaks a lot of him. And there's one more thing about Roger Brown that a lot of people don't know is that he founded very quietly. He underwrote a foster care program for troubled teens for its first 3 years. This started in 1986 in Dayton, and Roger really wanted to give back to the Dayton community because the Dayton community really picked him up when he was at the low point. And so these two women approached him that said they wanted to start a foster care program specifically for troubled teens, and Roger was the president of it and underwrote the whole thing for its first 3 years, and it lasted for more than 25 years. He didn't get a lot of press for that at all. But, again, it's that people have different sides, and that's a side to Roger that a lot of people might not know.
If I can chip in one more thing, and I won't bother anybody again, but when I spoke at Wingate when Ted interviewed me, I said, listen, we'd be idiots if we made a documentary and went to all this trouble about a guy because he could shoot a basketball. That's the stupidest thing in the world. There's nothing simpler and dumber than shooting a basketball. But when you become a person that does something, the basketball is just something he did well, but he was a good person. If he wasn't a good person, none of this would mean anything. And Joe shot a basketball very well and almost brought us a city championship single-handed. But Joel is a businessman. He runs a $1 million business. He's somebody. He does good works. You got to do more than just play a sport. A sport, it's ridiculous if you just play a sport. So the good that Roger did and his persona and what like Joel does and for philanthropy and things like that, that's what means something. And the basketball is just a hook. It's nice that you play a sport well, but you got to have more substance than that. And Roger had that substance. Joel has that substance. And anybody that we venerate has to have that substance, or else they just throw a ball in a hole or run with the ball over a goal line. It doesn't mean anything if you don't have that substance. And that's the thing that makes Roger's story, to me, worth all this trouble. Not just because he could shoot a ball well.
George, let me know.
I'm out.
George, along the same lines, Ted will tell you that cast of famous athletes that Ted interviewed, he'll tell you almost every one of them broke down in tears in their interviews. So
yeah, well, I can tell that.
What you're saying?
There's no question about it. I mean, I'm interviewing, just a story like this, you find yourself interviewing a bunch of guys who are between 6'6" and 7 feet tall, and these massive men, and they're breaking down again and again and again. This guy, I tell you what, when I pass away, I count myself lucky if a small handful of people shed tears. This guy, Roger Brown, made a lot of difference in a lot of people's lives, and again, things didn't really work out for him the way they should have, including, dying at the young age that he did. This story is about way more than basketball. This is a story about perseverance. And everybody agrees with that.
Well, one more thought, okay? The movie The Blind Side,
yes,
won an Academy Award about an African-American football player that lived with a white family, and became an All-American and a pro. That story doesn't hold a candle to this story. The Roger Brown story is so compelling. he was wronged to a degree where the story's got to get out there, and it will. And Ted, don't die before you finish this, because then I'll cry with you.
All right.
We'll come and get you. Well, I want to thank you guys for giving us the insight. Just a small peek, but I want the folks. Where can they get that? Take a look at the trailer, Ted.
Okay, they can take a look. They can get a look at the trailer. It's, you know what, it is now live on YouTube. We had it as a private link on YouTube for a long time. But if anybody wants to go to YouTube and type in Roger Brown documentary, in fact, I'm doing it here as we speak to make sure I'm saying this correctly, there are two trailers. There's the first trailer, the original one that we heard the beginning of was Slick Leonard reading his poem, and then there's the additional voices trailer, which includes Bill Cosby and Kareem and Reggie Miller and others. They're both there to be seen on YouTube, and in fact, underneath them is information again on how to contribute and how to contribute to this show. Type in Roger Brown and Undefeated. Undefeated is the working title of this. Thanks, I must say, to George Gass.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, they are. If you type in Roger Brown Undefeated in YouTube, the trailers come up as the first two things.
Okay, very good. Well, Joel, so since George has said these magnificent things about you and that, you know, we'll, they'll be able to see your face in this trailer also.
Well,
yeah, don't hold that against me, please.
There's no footage of you shooting the jump shot, though, Joel.
Well, he cut that out because I wore out the nets and But the tears in the trailer are real, I promise you.
Yes, they are. Your brother's in that trailer too, right?
Yes, he is. Les is in there. We filmed at Manhattan Beach, where we hadn't played ball in 50 years. And the courts are the same. The place is beautiful, but it was surreal going on those courts. And we met Ted there in August in the heat, and we sat in the sun, and we had a good time.
And you didn't have a bet?
Joe. Mention the title that goes before your brother's name and your son's name.
What, doctor?
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, that's something that, I mean, you're very proud of what you did with the basketball, but my God, that you have two doctors right there staring you in the face every other day. That means a lot, too.
Not to brag, but my other son and daughter are lawyers. So I made sure they got the education that I could have gotten the Wingate, but I was busy.
Yeah, well, we saw that one, the earth science class together.
Yeah, Mike, we were in earth science. No, I'm the only guy that got the frog died. The frog jumped off the table.
Hey, guys. Guys, I'm sorry, but I all of a sudden I've got family calling here, and I need to run.
Good. I want to thank you, Ted. Well, we're going to do this again, Ted.
Oh, I'd like to. I really enjoyed all this conversation. It's good stuff, and I got. Let me say,
yeah.
Both Joel and Gaff have taken a lot of their time to help with this. It means something to them, which makes it mean something to me. So.
Well, I'm going to be involved.
Right. Take it easy, Ted.
You too, George.
All right.
All right.
And Joe. Okay, Ted. Joe, I understand that you got some things going on today too.
Oh yeah. My grandson had his little thing taken care of.
that's my cue. Joel, I'll talk to you soon. Okay.
George, I'll send you the piece.
Okay.
No, that's all right.
Bye, guys.
All right, Joe. When's the last time you saw Sammy Stern?
I see Sammy. He lives down in South Florida near me. I see him. We have dinner once in a while, and he has two little sons that you know, he's teaching them the game of basketball. So Sammy's much involved with that almost every day.
But
I see Sam frequently.
Well, I want to thank you and George for coming on, and just we're going to be pushing this. I'm going to be pushing this every show. I'm going to push this.
Well,
so,
we appreciate it.
Hear it.
And the Roger Brown family appreciates it. It'll get out there.
Oh, yeah.
So,
it will get out
thanks.
There.
Thanks. Good talking to you.
It was great talking to you again, Joe.
Okay.
And, George, I will be talking to you. And I played the theme song from Skyfall today. I love that theme song. I can't wait for it to come out next week.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm waiting to review it.
Hey, okay. Hey guys. Why don't we meet a cafeteria?
Yeah. Where?
The Wingate.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that's good. Remember, it was only 32 cents for lunch if you had a token.
You know what? You got a point there. You're right.
32 cents for lunch with a token.
And Roger always asks to lend him a dime so he can get something to eat. And that's the truth. That's the truth. Every time I see him, yeah, he says, hey, Joe, you got a dime? You got a dime? I said, Roger, you got change of $10?
Okay.
When this documentary comes out, y'all ought to do a
documentary
showing for the students there, and it should be 32 cents to watch the
picture. Hey, do you know that? That's right. You do it. They do a complimentary showing for the students at Wingate High School in charge of 32 cents, which was the lunch money when we went there.
I got news for you. The Pacers should do that. 32 cents, you get to see a great documentary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right.
All right.
Okay, John. I
enjoy.
Thank you. And George,
all right, take care.
I'll talk to you later. What did you review today, George? What did you see?
That's a good question. I haven't got an idea in the world what I reviewed today. I liked it. Oh, Denzel Washington, Flight.
Oh, Flight. Oh.
Now,
yeah.
George, I'm gonna get really upset if you start forgetting Denzel. Come on, man.
Now,
I
like the part of that trailer where the plane was flying upside down.
Upside down. They do a good job of explaining that, too. They go into the detail. They get to show the technical thing of why that's possible. And it's a four-star picture.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping.
And four stars is our highest rating, so it's a good picture. No zombies, no talking cars. No machines fighting other machines, no vampires. That gives it 3 stars right there.
You mean no Texas Chainsaw Massacres?
Nobody's,
like?
No sadistic murders. Nobody's throwing hand grenades like Taken 2, throwing hand grenades off the roof into a crowd of people. It's a good picture.
Had dialogue? You mean they had that thing called dialogue?
And they had common sense, and they had some kind of logic to what they were doing, and they had a purpose, a plot.
Oh,
so it's not like what we've been getting here. I'm telling Argo in this picture, and I liked Cloud Atlas, but Cloud Atlas is not for everybody. Half the people that go see it won't like it, and the other half will love it. It's one of those pictures that you can't recommend it to people because half of them will like it, half of them will hate it. But I loved Argo, and I didn't understand it, but I loved it. You know, you didn't have to understand everything that was going on, and you could still appreciate it. It's
a very creative
picture.
As a movie critic, isn't that sort of backdoor something or other?
No, that's just the way it is. It's a fantasy picture, so everybody can't deal with it. And, you know, it's like Inception. Inception was wonderful, but I wasn't a big fan of Inception. But you like that. See, you like to put the puzzle together. I don't want too much of a puzzle, but I knew it was a good picture, but it wasn't my cup of tea, but it was a good picture.
Well,
hey, look, after watching all these Transformers movies, a little bit of a puzzle goes a long way.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. I'm telling you now, those zombies, vampires, Transformers, that's enough of them. I won't need to see them for 20 years, and I don't think I'll be here 20 years from now to see them. But that's enough. My goodness.
We should have Battleship 3 out by then.
Well, the film The Fear, Battleship 3, the film Inception, if you could get past the first dream state, you understood it. But if you couldn't get past the first one, you understand the first, maybe the second one. If you can't get past the second one, you're lost.
Again, my thing is, and I wrote this in one of the reviews, Batman, Superman, three rules. All you need is three rules.
Yeah.
Superman, born on another planet, has superpowers, and kryptonite will kill him. You know those three things, you can watch every Superman ever made. Batman, his parents were victims of a crime.
Right.
He hides his identity so that his friends can't be intimidated or harmed. And he is concerned about society, but he pretends that he's not. That's Batman. That's it. Now you can see Batman. Inception. If you're shot on a Monday when it's snowing, you'll die. But if you're shot on a Tuesday when it's not raining, you'll live. And this and that. And I'm telling you, it has more rules than Major League Baseball. That's all. You got to know all these rules. I'm telling you. You can't die if it's cloudy outside. And 1 minute becomes an hour if it's raining, but it's 2 minutes becomes a day if it's sunny. Oh, my goodness. And again, for people who like that, like Mikey likes that, he likes to figure this stuff out. I don't want to figure out stuff. I don't want to work. I didn't go to the movie to work. You got to take a notebook with you to figure this bitch out. I don't want that.
Yeah, well,
can I give you the Cliff Notes version of it? This is the easy one.
Yeah, that's what you need. They should give you a Cliff Note thing before when you walk in. But people don't want to sit there. This is what it means. Then they have to give you a little light so you can turn the light on while you're watching the picture so you can read the notebook.
If you want to expand Inception, just watch Batman.
But it's a good picture. I mean, I know it's a good picture, but it's not a picture that I want to see because I don't want to do the work.
Well, you say it again?
I said Batman 2 with the Joker. That was Inception explained better.
Maybe so, but you can follow it.
Well, see, now you have to realize that the psychic mind can do strange things, and that if we accept the psychic mind doing strange things, then all things are possible.
Well, let me say one more thing. I'm coming across something. I had a conversation with this. This is why I was barely able to get here on time, because two pitches are total ripoffs, and it puzzles me that people see them and don't realize this. The Hangover and The Hangover 2 is the exact same picture in another location. It's
right.
It's not a kid told me in the supermarket. He said, "Oh, I want to see the sequel." I said, "It's not a sequel. It's a carbon copy. There's a difference between a sequel. A picture grows. It enlightens you about some other aspect. The Hangover and Hangover 2 is the same picture. Taken 1 and Taken 2 is the exact same picture. It's a carbon copy. I mean, they're getting they're charging you twice to see the same picture at a new location." If King Kong climbs the Empire State Building in New York, and then you buy another movie for King Kong, and he climbs the Sears Tower in Chicago, that's the same picture. It's not a sequel. Nothing changed except the location. And people, how they tell you enthusiastically,
how did his wife and daughter going to get kidnapped now in a different?
By the same guys. It's the same picture. The daughter takes the place. The daughter's home worrying about the mother. In the other picture, the mother was worrying about the daughter. They're kidnapped by the same guys, and they tell you at the end of Taken 2 that there's going to be a Taken 3.
Oh,
they
God.
Tell you that.
No, wait a minute.
So,
Did he kill these guys?
That's the thing. He killed them. These are the relatives of the guys he killed. So as long as they got cousins, uncles, brothers, sisters, then he'll keep on running through the family. He killed the original guys, and now the relatives come after him. The grandfather and the cousins and the brothers come after him. And when they kill them, they say at the end of the picture, well, you know, we got some more cousins and brothers still left. They tell you that. And he's got more people to be kidnapped. I guess this time they'll kidnap an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent. They got the wife, they got the daughter. This time it's like some uncles or cousins or something that will get kidnapped. It's unbelievable. It's a carbon copy. It's the same dialogue. It's the same guys. Everything is the same except they change the city. The car chases are the same. Everything's the same except they change the city.
They're saying that this is almost like the Hatfield-McCoys did.
That's what it is. They're feuding, and everything is the same. I'm telling you, there's nothing different. It's no growth. It's nothing you learn that's enlightening. It's not like the Batman trilogy where you see different things happening. I wrote that there's like 20 James Bond movies, but he's not doing this. He's not Goldfinger. He's after. Then the next time he's after somebody else. And where he's at and what he's doing and the threat they pose, you know he's going to win. You know James Bond is going to kill him. You know he's going to win. You know he's going to save society and Western civilization. But they go about it with some passion, with some story, with some new insight, with some new characters. This is the same exact picture, except they change the city. I'm telling you, Las Vegas becomes Thailand, and then the other one, Paris becomes Istanbul. Same picture. I can't do it any more than that. And like I said before, they charge you the same money for both of them, so that stays consistent.
Well, so you're saying it's like Rambo 1 and Rambo 2.
But Rambo, I think even Rambo did something. I think he moved to another location and he veered off in something. But the same. This is exactly the same. I mean, there's no writers. They just saw he wore a green shirt. This time he'll wear a blue shirt. He wore boots. This time he'll wear sneakers. That's about the only difference in these pictures.
Now wait a minute. I heard him say in the trailer, he says, "Daddy, what are you going to do?" He said, "This time I'm going to finish it. I should have did what I did. I didn't do the first time." I mean, that's what he says.
Okay. And he shoots, and so that means he shoots more of the same people. He may shoot more of the same people, but it's the same. It's a nightmare. I mean, and then they're going to have a third one.
They said that they're
going to
have a third one?
Yeah, there's a Taken 3. They tell you at the end, guy tells them, well, you know our cousins are going to come after you and stuff. Killed the original sons and things, and he killed a grandfather in this one.
Yeah.
And now he's got the cousins are coming after him. And there's one more son left. There's one more son and the cousins left in Taken.
They had to do a trilogy, huh?
Well, that's because...
They'll do 20 of them. You kidding? They'll be killing the aunts and the uncle. They'll be getting around them up at the senior citizens' home and trucking them in to get killed. And he just kills them like butter. I mean, he runs like a hot knife through butter killing these people. You know?
It doesn't matter.
He hasn't got a wound on him.
He says, well, you know, that's the thing that struck me about James Bond and the different take that Craig brought to the film.
Craig is the new Bond,
He is every time you see him, he's got nicks and cuts and broken black eyes.
He gets hurt.
He just, man, that never happened in any other James Bond. They never got
hurt. Gets hurt. Yeah, but see, there's only two James Bond. Sean Connery's the only James Bond to me, and then Craig is the new James. He's not playing Sean Connery's James Bond.
He is
playing the new cell phone, laptop, pad, memo pad, whatever the hell it's called. He's the new James Bond, and that's fine. He's not trying to imitate Sean Connery. He's the new James Bond. But these other guys, to me, Timothy Dalton and them, they were too small and they agonized over killing somebody. They tried to, I don't want to shoot anybody. Sean shoot you. If you needed to be shot, he shot you. And he didn't have to agonize over it. He never agonized. These guys are agonizing. Pierce Brosnan, they agonize. And Roger Moore thought it was a comedy series. He never played it seriously. And he couldn't play it seriously because he's not physical enough.
Sean
Connery and Daniel Craig are the only two James Bonds I recognize.
Well, that's true. I said that at the beginning of the show when I first started the show. That's what I talked about. And my sentiments are directly that there's only two James Bonds, and one is Sean Connery, and then there's the new James Bond with Daniel Craig, and Daniel Craig is taking it, as the Joker says, he took it out a whole new door.
Well, look, one thing that I'll say as a reader, you know, I actually read all the original James Bond. These books were rough. James had a rough career. He got hurt in every single adventure, and he would come through at the skin of his teeth with a knife in the side and a bullet through the shoulder. And because it was a rough man's adventure spy series in the 50s, 60s when he came out of that era. And I think that he has brought that back to that nitty gritty, getting by the skin of your teeth realism back to the series. And that's one thing I love about
the new James Bond. Look at the Roger Moore ones. Roger Moore barely got a wrinkle in his shirt because he didn't play it like that. Sean played it rough, and Craig plays it super rough. I mean, Craig is damn near heading for the emergency room halfway through the picture. But Roger Moore was like, oh, me, his hair was messed up. He was upset. Roger Moore you know James Bond's going to prevail, but Roger Moore was like, oh, he's shooting a guy and making jokes. He never had that roughed up thing. I don't remember him having a good fight. I'm telling you, his hair, he never had to have his hair out of place in the whole picture.
That hairspray, you know, super hairspray.
I guess so.
Well, all right, Dad. We'll talk about this next. You're going next week. You're going to see it, right? The premiere is
next week it opens. Yeah, I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, I'm going to go see if I can go online now. Make sure I get my tickets in advance.
Well, anything doesn't have vampires in it, I'll go see. Look at these vampires.
Vampires is
not a big problem. You don't hear Obama calling the governor of the state talking about, I can help you with those vampires.
Well, wasn't President Lincoln talking about vampires in the film?
Oh, but I tell you, they did a pretty good job in that Lincoln vampire thing. I give them credit. That's such a wild premise. They did a good job of making it seem reasonable, and they did a good job of making it reasonable. I gotta take that as an exception.
I did not see that film because of that. I said, this ain't even reasonable.
they made it seem relatively reasonable. I got to give them credit for it. That's what I said. I said, I just appreciate the fact that they really made this seem like it was reasonable. The president's running around bumping off these vampires, but they made it.
How can you say that's reasonable and you can't understand Inception?
Well, I'll never get Inception. I appreciate it. I knew it was good, but I couldn't get it. Now, you know, but I'm knocking Inception, but I just couldn't get it. I couldn't keep up with the rules, I'm telling you. Okay, well, take it easy.
I want you to give us a critique. At Rice here, too, we'll give a critique together on the air.
Of what's the name next week? Skyfall? Oh, you won't see it. You'll have to do 2 weeks because you won't see it next week. You won't see it in time for the show.
Okay. We'll talk about 2 weeks.
Okay.
All right.
I'm signing off.
Good. Right,
take care.
Talk to
you. All right. Take it easy, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. I love that theme song. But I like the theme song. I mean, Daniel Craig said he heard the first three lines of the song and he fell in love with it. But now, we got something, a little something that's happening next week. We got a little something that's happening next week.
What's a little something?
So something that you know.
Something happening in America,
basically? Yeah, as a matter of fact, let me play a little bit of it here.
Yep. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Yeah, the shadow knows. And who are we talking about here? We're talking about John Henry Sununu. Does everybody know who he is? John Henry Sununu.
It's going back a ways for some of you. May have
oh, really?
Mind.
Well, John Henry Sununu was born in Havana, Cuba.
Oh,
mother was born in Havana, and his father was Lebanese. As a matter of fact, he later became the governor of New Hampshire.
So, in a
and then the chief of staff for Papa Bush.
Ah, yes, George H.W.
Yes. And he was responsible for recommending David Souter on the Supreme Court. And the conservatives wanted to run his butt out of this country because David Souter became a liberal judge. But he was recommended to him by Warren Rudman, who was the senator up there.
Right.
And but Warren Rudman really was not conservative. Warren Rudman was really leaning towards the liberal side. And what happened was that when he got in, the Republicans saw what happened here. They said, this guy's unbelievable. He said, and Souter was, Warren Rudman said later, he said that with pride, he said that he was able to slip this Mr. Souter to the gullible White House Chief of Staff, John Sununu, as a confirmable conservative. Then they both sold the judge to President Papa Bush, who wanted to avoid any confrontations because he just had this big Bork battle.
Oh, yeah, Bork. Robert Bork.
Robert Bork.
Well, I guess that can be said then to be the good thing that ever came out of the Bush years.
That's right. Now, here's some of the things that this John Henry Sununu has done.
Well, let me just say this before you
get
into that, because you know, I get disappointed with people from time to time. And this is a case of someone I get disappointed in. Because here's a gentleman who should be better than he is. This is a son of immigrants. He obviously is what you would call an American success story. Because here he is, Cuban, Lebanese, come to America, he goes to school, gets multiple degrees, and then rises through the ranks into politics to do things like sit in the White House itself and advise the President of the United States.
The second most powerful man in the world.
Okay. So,
Chief of Staff.
Isn't that a great story? Isn't that wonderful? And then let's see just how bad it can get.
Well, we see how bad it can get.
Yeah.
Sununu started taking personal ski trips.
What?
And using them as classified them for purposes of conservation.
Conservation.
Promoting the 1,000 points of light. Remember that 1,000
points
of light?
Oh, 1,000 points of gold in his pocket. Oh.
And then he used to take these ski, these junkets and the jets with the Fast Cat Republicans running ski trips and golf trips and even the dental trip to Boston.
You know, teeth are important. The taxpayers.
And in one ski trip to Vail, Colorado alone cost the taxpayers $86,330.
Well, you know, it costs a lot to ski. And it costs a lot more to ski in a very, very
absolutely
ski resort.
Absolutely. And then Sununu, but he did pay back $892 of that money.
Well, that's generous of him. But you might want to note only after getting caught.
He paid back $892, but the trip, because he used military travel, was $615,000.
Right.
So, he said, well, I had to use one of the White House planes because I had to be, for national security, I had to be close to a phone. I guess this is just before we had the cell phones.
Well, you know, this gets back to my point about disappointments. The Republican brand likes to present itself. Yes, you may have seen it on the backs of bumpers. Their brand is the American flag.
Oh, right.
They're the grown-ups that are responsible for all national security. Mm-hmm. If it weren't for them, America would now be a communist outpost.
You mean it's not?
Well, you know, those Democrats have tried for decades, but luckily our great leaders, the Republicans, have saved us from that fate. But
well,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
They constantly do things like this. This is a man using our military at hundreds of thousands of dollars per day to fly him and his friends and all around for martinis all over the country. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine the scandal if, like, the Obama administration did things like that?
Or
Michelle? The military? Now, these are our patriotic family values guys, and they just use America's security resources.
Hey, if it's there,
their private,
it's
party.
There, use it. Now, the White House counsel, C. Gordon Gray at the time, said, you can't do this. So he allowed him to pay $47,000 back towards that $315,000. He said, now, things got worse when there was rumors of financial difficulty in Sununu's family, and he traveled to a rare stamp auction at Christie's. This is the coup de grace. In a government limousine.
So he drove from Washington to Christie's,
yes,
in New York City.
Okay. Spending $5,000 on rare stamps. Then Sununu sent the car and the driver back to Washington unoccupied while he took a corporate jet home.
Because I guess, you know, once he drove up there, he said, heck, that took a long time.
Now,
I think I'm going to fly.
Now, I want to tell you how bad it got. Junior George W. Bush told his father, the man's got to go.
Now, when W.
Actually, when W. tells you, you got to go, you got to go. He
There's
was gone. That's right. Sununu has no defendant. He don't have any defendants.
See, this should remind people that people often forget this, but W's role before he was given the presidency, he never actually won the presidency, he was given the presidency, but before he was given the presidency as a reward for his father, he served his father as, if you remember this, quotation marks, and during that time, he was the enforcer.
Exactly.
He's the one who used to go around breaking knees and getting those Republicans. Because if you remember back then, in our wonderful world of Republicans, the Bushes were the outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
They were those kind of wishy-washy, liberal, kind of we don't really know, we don't trust them, we don't know them guys. And so he had to go running around making sure that they all kowtowed to the Bushes. And I think it's ironic that the enforcer is the one who brought down the hammer.
That's right.
So to speak, delay.
Now, you know, Sununu, he has no defenders in the Republican Party. The people just because of what he almost did to the Republican Party. But you see, he was like the person who was now the Republican Party, the Regressive Party. And this and now with
back in favor,
that's right.
Back up all over the place.
And with all this in mind, you see, Sununu now is the chief surrogate for Willard Mitt Romney.
Yep.
Now, Sununu, after 21 years of being out of sight and kept in the ghost box used in the film Ghostbusters, which was then buried deep in an underground dungeon, believing that when it was time for his rising, everyone who might have been aware of him would either be dead or senile.
You know, that's kind of like that scene when
Sununu
get that job in Pennsylvania, and you get there, and the big castle is kind of empty, and you don't know what's going on. But then at night, it's time for dinner.
Yes.
You hear that crypt of it.
Well, that's the thing. That day you thought the people were dead or senile, Sununu crawled out like that virus from the X-Files to spread his racist toxicity. It should not come to anybody's shock that this creepy crawler, what this creepy crawler wants. He wants rehabilitation.
Oh, really?
So, what does he do?
Hey, you know what?
The first time for rehabilitation? Let me show you what he does. All right, so then I will play it. I will
play
it.
That was Johnson.
And that was Johnson.
That's everything.
And where's he at now? Yeah, no, here it is. This is what he said. Oh, no, that's the wrong one. Nope, I don't want to play that one. Where is this out here?
Will you endorse President Obama this race?
Nope, that's the wrong one. That's the wrong one.
Yeah. Johnson is not going to endorse the ball. No, I don't think so. Oh, I thought we had in there for a minute.
Here it is. This is what it is.
The men and women all over America who have worked hard to build these businesses, their businesses, from the ground up, is how our economy became the envy of the world. It is the American way. And I wish this president would learn how to be an American.
That was former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu on a Romney campaign conference call a few moments ago.
He wants this president
to
learn how to be American when this man wasn't even born in this country.
Well, this is, yet again, like I said, another disappointing example. Just like Romney wants all of those dirty Mexicans to go and export themselves back across the border or maybe jump that fence back over when he himself, his family, comes from Mexico. Again, it's mind-blowing. Why do these people act that way?
Why do they act this way? Well, you know, if we only knew why people
what
act
evil
this
lurks
way, what evil lurks in the hearts of men, only the shadow knows. That's all. Now the other thing is
what else is
there? Now the this guy there wasn't any other things that he said that was that unusual except that when the president no, that's the wrong one too. Where are we at here? Oh, there it is. Nope.
I
need to remember where it's at, and I can't remember where it's at. It's around here somewhere, but anyway, I know where it's at. Let me see here. If it's on this page, it should be on this page. Let's see if this opens up here. Opening? Nope. It didn't close. So I guess I can't play it. But anyway, he called the President of the United States
lazy. Now, just listen to this.
Well, Governor, I know you're not going to be shy. So how did you think he did? And are you pleased by the performance? He's gotten rave reviews almost universally.
Andrea, what people saw last night, I think, was a president that revealed his incompetence, how lazy and detached he is, and how he has absolutely no idea how serious the economic problems of the country are and how he has failed to even begin to address them. And I think even the liberal press reacted with shock at this revelation, and I find it fascinating now this morning after they've slept to watch them all scrambling around to clean up the mess the president left on the floor last night. On the other hand, Mitt Romney came in with a lot of specifics, a lot of very sharp knowledge of issues, not only with the Obama version of bumper sticker numbers, but the governor showed that he understands policy and he understands how to make policy into law, talking
governor,
about what he did in Massachusetts.
Governor, I want to give you a chance to maybe take it back. Did you really mean to call Barack Obama, the President of the United States, lazy?
Yes. I think you saw him admit it the night before when he delivered the pizzas. He said, you know, they're making me do this work. He didn't want to prepare for this debate. He's lazy and disengaged.
Now,
I like how he doubles down on it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
No, did you misunderstand me? Let me make sure I got that pizza boy reference
right,
in there.
Right, right, right. I mean, right. Oh, they're making me do this.
Now, listen.
They're making me do this.
What I love about this fat cat kettle calling the President Black situation that we got going on is this is a guy calling the President of the United States, who I might want to remind people doesn't take month-long vacations every year like another president. This is a guy calling him lazy and disengaged and disinterested. You know, this guy flies military jets back and forth across the country to collect stamps and to get, you know, his dentist appointment on time. I guess when you just got to get there, an F-16 gets you there, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I mean, this guy is calling other people lazy when he's charging $615,000 in military jet time to the American taxpayers so that he can get that stamp collection up to date. I mean, I don't understand these people. I don't understand what do they think. Do they just, like, say anything that flies out of their mouth?
Well, yes. Well, here's one more thing he said. Just listen to this.
Final question. Colin Powell has decided to opt for President Obama again, despite apparently still being a Republican. Is it time he left the party, do you think? Well, I'm not sure how important that is. I do like the fact that Colin Powell's boss, George Herbert Walker Bush, has endorsed Mitt Romney all along. And frankly, when you take a look at Colin Powell, you have to wonder whether that's an endorsement based on issues or whether he's got a slightly different reason for preferring President Obama.
What reason would that be?
Well, I think when you have somebody of your own race that you're proud of being president of the United States, I applaud Colin for standing with him.
Johnson, nice to talk to you. He is insulting his own general that was there during the Bush years.
I mean,
the war.
But you notice what he said? His boss.
Yeah.
I mean, his boss.
Hey, again, it's always putting those people in their place.
Now, let me just.
Like pizza boy guy?
That's right, the pizza boy guy.
Will you endorse President Obama this race?
Well, you know, I voted for him in 2008, and I plan to stick with him in 2012, and I'll be voting for Vice President Joe Biden next month. Not only am I not comfortable with what Governor Romney is proposing for his economic plan, I have concerns about his views on foreign policy. I mean, it's a moving target. One day he has a certain strong view about staying in Afghanistan, but then on Monday night he agrees with the withdrawal. Same thing in Iraq. On almost every issue that was discussed on Monday night, Governor Romney agreed with the president with some nuances. But this is quite a different set of foreign policy views than he had earlier in the campaign. And my concern, which I've expressed previously in a public way, is that sometimes I don't sense that he has thought through these issues as thoroughly as he should have. There are other issues as well, not just the economy and foreign policy. I'm more comfortable with President Obama and his administration when it comes to issues like, what are we going to do about climate? What are we going to do about immigration? What are we going to do about education? Lots of things like that. I also saw the president get us out of one war, start to get us out of a second war, and did not get us into any new wars. And finally, I think that the actions he has taken with respect to protecting us from terrorism have been very, very solid. And so I think we ought to keep on the track that we are on.
The thing is, how do you take what this moron, draft dodger, says against a general who's someone who served us in three different capacities as Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and head of the Joint Chiefs, what he says over what this moron said?
Right.
How is it even related?
Kicked out of Washington for 20 years in disgrace.
Kicked out of Washington, came crawling out like that virus from the X-Files.
Yeah, he has the audacity to insult the general who won the war. That his boss was famous.
Right. That his boss, that he, how he made his boss famous.
And to put it in perspective, he's insulting a guy, all right, who's, when he uses a military jet that the American taxpayers pay for, it's because he was flying over Baghdad winning a war. Okay?
Yes.
This guy was using his jet to go flying over bail to make sure he got to the snowy slopes, you know, using the jet to make sure that he zipped downtown New York City to get some stamps. At the same time, again, this general was serving his nation and protecting American lives and winning a war overseas. And yet he has the audacity to insult him and call him, you know, oh, he's backing him because he's black. I'm sick of these people. They're thugs. And I don't understand why they let them come back again and again and again. It's kind of like, what's that stuff called? Herpes?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Here's the thing. It's just like, you know, if it wasn't for, well, say this about Romney. I don't believe Romney's a conservative, at least. I think Romney flows with the wind. But here's the problem, that Romney is almost like HIV, because when you get him, not just getting him, you're getting everybody else that slept with him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
You're getting all these moronic, homicidal, lunatic friends, theocratic numbskulls, from the ultra-right, all these women haters, but the main group you're going to get with him are these people that want to send the Supreme Court back to the dark ages. That's who you're getting when you vote for Romney.
Yeah.
So he's like the HIV, because you just don't get him alone. You get all the baggage that comes with it. That's what you're getting when you get Romney.
And that's the other thing that bothers me most. You know, we've talked before about the importance of having an actual balance in the system. You don't want to have just, I mean, hey, it'd be great if we could just have the next, you know, 50 years of nothing but liberals in office controlling the whole system. Oh, that'd be great. I think we'd make a lot of progress. But you have to have balance in politics.
That's right.
You can't swing
the pendulum all one direction, right? And we talked about the importance of having a strong Republican Party because you need balance. And it keeps, you know, even our party from going too far, too extreme. So you get a balance, and it's important. There should be balance in life and in law. That's the whole point of our courts, for instance. You had to have actual balance and not totally biased opinions. But I don't understand with the Republicans why they keep endlessly chasing the diehard freak show voter, you know, down to the last crazy church and KKK convention to try to find somebody more extreme than the last week. You know, and also why their hierarchy seems to have been abandoned by anyone coming up in the field and taken over by all of these retrograde guys. I mean, what have we talked about for the last 10 years? Nothing but guys from like the 1970s. We've had Dick Cheney's and Army and now Sununu back. Why?
We're going back to the future.
Yeah, it's dinosaurs all the way. I mean, what are rhinosaurs or what?
Well, everybody get out and vote and remember that you do not have to show your ID. If you show your ID, they ask you for your ID, it's because that you might have filled out your paperwork wrong. They're checking everything. Make sure your Social Security number's on there, making sure you have the correct address if you have moved. Because I had two people call me today and said, oh, they asked for my ID. I said, well, was your Social Security number correct on the paperwork that they had in front of them? No, I had to give them a corrected number. They had a number wrong. Well, that's the reason why. Get out and vote. We need to elect Democrats and Barack Obama, except Larry Kissinger. But anyway,
get out and vote.
And I'm going to leave you with my song. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm leaving you with my song. Diamond, professional cleaning service.